You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we kick off a new series called First Wisconsinites, dispatches from Native American life in Wisconsin today. We'll start with a look at education.
First, the U.S. Supreme Court will begin what is expected to be one of its most pivotal terms in decades. A full bench will consider cases on immigration, religious liberty, voting rights, and more.
A lot of people will be watching Justice Neil Gorsuch, who's settling into his role as a conservative justice like his predecessor Antonin Scalia. That means the bench again has five more or less conservatives and four more or less liberals now.
Ryan Owens is an expert on the Supreme Court and also a professor of political science and affiliate law faculty at UW-Madison. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the composition of the court as we head into this new term. How would you kind of divvy up the bench and what to expect?
I think this term will be a lot like, you know, what we expected. We'll have four more conservative justices, four liberal justices, and then we'll have Justice Kennedy in the middle. In some cases, we may have Chief Justice Roberts in the middle with him, but I think the most obvious rendering of the court right now is going to be a 4-1-4 split.
And in terms of how what we can expect from the newest justice on the bench, Justice Neil Gorsuch, what have we seen so far, and what can that tell us about what we might see from him coming up?
We've seen two things from Gorsuch already. The first is what I think most of us expected, and that he is a fairly conservative justice. I think he's going to be on the right on many issues. He's voted, in the last term, he voted quite a bit with Justice Thomas and Justice Alito as well. So the three of them seem to have a nice coalition forming. The other thing we saw about Justice Gorsuch, though, is that he doesn't lack confidence, and I don't mean that in a bad way or anything. He's been a judge for a number of years now. He knows what he thinks on most issues. He doesn't seem to be hesitant to sort of strike out on his own. For example, a lot of justices, when they get on the Supreme Court, they join what's called the cert pool, and that's just a collection of the justices' law clerks. They divvy up the work at the agenda setting stage so that each office doesn't have to read all of the petitions for review. If they divvy those up, collectively, they can spare some time. Gorsuch got to the court and realized right off the bat that he didn't want to be in that cert pool, and he's going to have his clerks do all of the filtering, the sifting, and the winnowing of the cases. So this is not a guy who thinks that he needs to rely on everybody else for support, and you can do what you will with that, but I think those are the two things that we really see from him.
And he's filling the seat of the vacated seat by Antonin Scalia. In terms of whether or not he also fills that same role, does it look as though he is taking a similar tactic as Scalia did?
I think that's right for the most part. He's likely to be in the same coalitional breakdowns as Scalia was. He may be a little bit further to the right on a number of issues than Scalia was. We'll have to see. I think on some criminal law matters, he might be a little bit more conservative than Scalia was. Certainly, he has a different viewpoint on federal agencies and the degree to which courts should defer to those agencies. Scalia was, for most of his career, of the opinion that courts should defer to agencies, though later in his tenure on the court, he seemed to sort of waver on that a little bit. But Gorsuch, he doesn't believe in that. So pretty similar in most respects, yes.
Well, let's dig into the cases a bit. We've got the Wisconsin partisan redistricting case tomorrow, a first look there. What are you expecting from that? Give us an overview.
Well, it's an interesting case that has some pretty serious ramifications. So as many of your listeners may know, the question involves partisan gerrymandering, which is essentially whether or not a state legislature can draw up district lines with pure partisan interest. So we all know that they're supposed to divide these districts up by traditional districting principles, county lines, city lines, geographical areas of interest like rivers, that sort of thing. But every 10 years after the federal government takes a census, states are supposed to reallocate how those districts are created, right? Because some areas gain population, some areas lose population, and you're supposed to keep a roughly proportionate population in your district. So this is a necessary thing. It has to be done. And the question, though, is how are you going to do it? What are the principles on which you are going to rely when you make those decisions? Now, political parties for decades, centuries, have been taking politics into consideration when they've created these lines. It's just that nowadays, the technology for drawing those lines is so good that you can draw them one way or another, depending on what interest you have in mind. So the question in this case was whether Wisconsin, like other states, Maryland and others, have gone too far when they crafted these districts and therefore violated the Equal Protection Clause and the First Amendment, which is treating some voters differently than other voters.
We're talking to Ryan Owens right now, professor of political science and affiliate law faculty at UW-Madison, giving us a look at what's coming up this term in the U.S. Supreme Court, and looking still at that partisan redistricting case out of Wisconsin. A lot of eyes on that one, Ryan. Is part of the case whether one side can come up with a test of sorts that can prove that something is happening. I know this has been something that has eluded others in the past who've taken this issue before the court.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that really is the linchpin of this entire case, is whether or not the attorneys can convince Justice Kennedy in particular whether there is a workable standard here. Back in 2004, the Supreme Court heard a similar case. And four of the justices at that time said these claims are just, they're non-justiciable, right? Which is to say, there's nothing that we as judges can come up with that seems to be workable. It's a political question. We're just going to screw it up if we get involved with this. Now, Justice Kennedy did not join that opinion. He said, by and large, yeah, I agree with you guys today, but I'm not going to foreclose the possibility that in the future we might come up with a workable standard. So everyone right now is targeting Justice Kennedy. If you read the briefs, they are crafted directly with Justice Kennedy in mind. They reference him like crazy. So the question will be, can they come up with a standard that is manageable for lower courts? Because if they can't, lower courts are going to be inundated with these lawsuits. There will be no consistent application of the law. And that's just, frankly, not a good thing either. So the trick here is going to be whether or not they've come up with a workable standard. Now, I will say, in the lower court, the litigants had this thing that they called the efficiency gap, which was basically, it looked at wasted votes, whether, some candidates were winning by huge margins, other candidates were losing by slight margins. And to the extent that there were margins one way or the other, it was lopsided, you could say that there were wasted votes. Now, people have suggested that the efficiency gap is sort of quantitatively good or bad, but at minimum, it was a standard. What I see now is the parties in their cert briefs and now in their merit briefs, the challengers of the redistricting ploy sort of moved away from that standard. And now they said, well, you can choose from this approach, you can choose from the other approach, you can choose from a different approach. And I don't think that inures to their benefit.
And if you look at how outside factors might weigh or not weigh on the court, as the case may be, President Obama, this has become an issue close to his heart. Arnold Schwarzenegger has weighed in on this, saying it's a power issue, not a partisan issue. Does any of that matter, the voices we're hearing outside the court?
Well, look, I think there are going to be a number of people with different perspectives on this. Some will look at it through the lens of partisanship. You can't ignore the fact that for decades, when Democrats controlled state legislatures in the South and various parts across the country, that they did exactly the same thing.
Including in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so it's not one side. It's not like Republicans are doing this and Democrats never did. But some people may look at it that way. The other way to look at this, though, and this is a lot more complicated for people to get a handle on, is so you have that issue, but then you also have the issue of who do you want deciding this kind of stuff? Do you really want judges to be the ones that make the decisions here? If we cede this authority to the courts, is this just another example of us sort of ceding our liberties to an unelected branch of government that'll make the decision? That's a lot harder. I think there are going to be a lot of people who say, you know what, I don't like the partisan redistricting. We think it's an affront to democracy, or you pick the expression, but might nevertheless be uncomfortable having a court pick the right number.
We're talking with Ryan Owens, an expert on the Supreme Court and professor at UW-Madison. And we're looking now at the upcoming Supreme Court term, which will take on hot-button issues on immigration, religious liberty, partisan redistricting, and more.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What Supreme Court cases are you most concerned with this year? Are you hopeful or worried about the position that the court could take on key issues related to immigration, partisan redistricting or gerrymandering, religious liberty? What do you expect from the newest Justice Neil Gorsuch? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we'll pick up the conversation and maybe hear from you in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation now about the U.S. Supreme Court session with Ryan Owens. He's an expert on the Supreme Court and a professor at UW-Madison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us, which cases are you watching this term? How do you want the Supreme Court to rule on things like gerrymandering, religious liberty, voting rights, immigration? Are you hoping that the court takes up President Donald Trump's travel ban? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we'll go to our callers first. We have Nathan joining us in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was going to say that I am much more comfortable with nonpartisan judges drawing district lines, even though they're not elected at the federal level, at the state level they are elected, than I am with people who are partisans and trying very hard not to face an election and basically be unelected partisans. And with gerrymandering, that is a rigged election. Therefore, all these people are not facing elections for an entire decade. And I think that's terrible for a state legislature.
Nathan, we leave it there. Thank you for your comment. And Ryan, Nathan, coming down on the side of the judges in terms of who gets to draw the lines of the districts. But I want to ask you a big picture question. What are the ramifications of this one? This is a big one, and this goes well beyond Wisconsin. How big is the scope of this decision?
It ultimately depends on what the court's rule is that it crafts. It has a number of things that it could say. It could say, look, these are just so wound up in partisanship and they're so inherently political that we're not going to touch that. All right. If they do that, it's a fairly large decision, but not sort of the backbreaking consequences that many people think. Alternatively, you could come up with something more akin to a standard and say you can't unduly account for partisanship. Okay, well, what would that mean? I have absolutely no idea, and neither would the lower courts. They'd have to litigate this thing quite a bit to figure it out. So I think that sort of thing would be problematic. Alternatively, what they could do is they could just pick a number. They could say, an efficiency gap or something above 7% is inherently problematic. That would be somewhat arbitrary, but I suppose they could look at existing case law in terms of, racial discrimination in districts to maybe find a value like that. So it just depends how they craft this. And if they craft it the wrong way, so to speak, it could have some pretty profound implications. It could bring the lower courts into quite a bit of litigation. If they craft it in a limited capacity, we may not see that sort of thing. It all depends on who writes the opinion and how well they write it.
Nathan, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Bill joining us in Onalaska. Hello, Bill.
Hello. I would like to see every district gerrymandered so that they were all extremely competitive. I believe that would make a huge difference for our country.
I'm sorry, Bill, we're losing you there, but we got the core of his comment there. He wants to see districts be competitive. Ryan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a great point. I mean, I think Bill's comment is something that a lot of people today want to see. They probably want to see more competitive elections where you have moderate candidates come out, people who can compromise more. And look, I mean, that's a legitimate perspective on this. I think, it kind of harkens back to Nathan's question earlier, which was, who gets to decide this? And There are possibilities. It doesn't have to be a legislature. It doesn't have to be a judge. Arizona recently adopted a sort of an independent redistricting commission. There are options such as that. I'm certainly not advocating one versus the other, but it doesn't have to be an all or one thing. There are probably ways to get more input than if you give it to judges, but there are alternatives out there.
Well, moving on from that redistricting case, the travel ban was supposed to have been taken up by the court. That's going to be postponed. Can you give us a quick update on the status of that, Ryan?
Well, I think what happened there is what a lot of us expected, is that that initial travel ban was going to expire after 90 days. And after that expired, the question is, would it render the controversy moot? Right. And I think the president's new travel ban effectively did that. It rendered that existing controversy moot. And I think at this point, there's really nothing for them to decide because that old travel ban is gone. Now, I suspect this new travel ban will, of course, be challenged as well. And that will play out in the lower courts and potentially back up to the Supreme Court later.
We're talking to Ryan Owens right now from UW-Madison, where he's a professor of political science and affiliate law faculty, an expert on the Supreme Court, taking a look at the new Supreme Court term, which has a number of pretty big cases in it. It's going to be consequential, looks like, any way you slice it. And one of these big cases, Ryan, is centered around religious liberty, and in particular, a cake shop owner who did not want to provide a wedding cake honoring a same-sex couple. Can you walk us through that one?
Sure. So this was a case out of Colorado. Colorado, like approximately 20 or 25 other states, has a statute that says that you can't deny someone your services as a function of their sexual orientation. So here, if you make a cake for opposite-sex couples, you also have to do that for same-sex couples. So a couple that had gotten married in a different state came back to Colorado, wanted to have a reception there. They walked into the shop and they told the shop owner that they wanted a cake. So they sat down, they started talking about it. The shop owner said, "Oh, is this for a wedding?" And they said, "Yes, it's for our wedding." And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I won't do that. That violates my religious principles. if it's for any other purpose, most any other purpose, I'll make the cake, but not for same-sex marriages. I won't make any cakes," he says, "that have alcohol in them. I won't make cakes for Halloween, things that violate my religious preferences." So they sued under that Colorado statute, and the opinion came out in their favor. So the question now is whether or not, it depends how you frame it too, right? Whether or not forcing him to make a cake violates his First Amendment principles, or alternatively, whether allowing him to discriminate against them violates their equal protection rights. So it'll be interesting to see how this case comes out. It's not a slam dunk. A lot of people think, you know, Anthony Kennedy was so important with the Obergefell decision, with Lawrence versus Texas, and with others, that this is his legacy and he's going to want to adhere closely to it and protect it. I think that's all true, but on the other hand, he's also been a pretty firm believer in First Amendment rights and free association rights. So these two are sort of coming into to clash with one another, and the question is, which side is he going to fall on? If I had to put money on it, I would say he's likely to side with the gay rights advocates, but he may do so in a limited way, try to find some way where he can find a compromise that says you can put up a sign in your place of business that suggests you don't support this or something. But I do think he sort of leans in that direction. But again, it's not a slam dunk.
And the Trump administration has thrown its weight behind the cake shop owner. Is there a sense of what public opinion is, and does it matter, as it did when we looked at the decision to legalize same-sex marriages, where there were decades building up in support of it?
Well, two things to say on that. The first is a little bit more narrow and legalistic, but the way they've come in on this, the Trump administration, is to say that we're supporting the cake shop because we think we can formulate a very limited test here, which is a test focusing on expression. So if you're engaged in an expressive activity as your profession, then you can say, nope, that violates my religious liberties.
And I noticed the baker in question is billing himself as a cake artist. Does that matter?
Well, it might. I mean, the court will let us know. I think, you know, it's just a question of where this distinction is going to lay. But I think there's probably something to it. You know, crafting something is different than just reproducing something that's boilerplate. So that's the first thing with the Trump administration, where they come down. And ultimately, that may be the test that satisfies Kennedy. The other issue with this, though, is whether or not you see Obergefell as a sword or a shield or what have you. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say, look, the justices were comfortable with Obergefell and most of society was comfortable with it because all they were doing there was sort of protecting someone's right to engage in some kind of activity. But now if you go this step further with it and you say, oh, you have to serve this group with which you may disagree, well, that's a very different thing. Now you're telling people that they have to engage in something, and that could generate some backlash from the public.
That's another big one to keep an eye on. And let's move to another as we get a little short on time here, one involving privacy and cell phones here.
Yep. So Carpenter versus U.S., it's a question about whether or not police can access your cell phone location records without a warrant. So at issue in this case was a suspect in a robbery case. Police reached out to his telephone company and said, we want to know where this guy was. And you can detect that from the cell tower locations. And so they used that against him in the court of law. And the question was, ought they have to have gotten a warrant? There's a doctrine out there called the third party doctrine, which is if you voluntarily give your information over to a third party, you can't reasonably expect privacy. And the question is whether the court will apply that or something else in this case.
And I've got about 30 seconds left. Is there anything else that you're keeping a keen eye on this term?
Well, there's another really important case on public agency fees. The Supreme Court stands poised, I think I'm almost convinced of it, that they're going to strike down public sector union fees for non-members of the union. It's just too inherently, I think the court will say it's too inherently tied up with politics. It'll violate your First Amendment rights to be forced to do that.
We'll leave it there. Ryan, thanks a lot for coming in today.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot.
Ryan Owens is a professor of political science and affiliate law faculty at UW-Madison. He joined us to preview the new Supreme Court term, considering a lot of big cases, including partisan redistricting, religious liberty, and also this privacy issue we were talking about a bit ago. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're kicking off a new series today called First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. And we start today with a look at education.
Jason Dropick joins us now. He's the head of the Indian Community School in Milwaukee. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Bonjour. Thank you so much, Miigwech, for having us, Veronica.
Well, I wonder if we could start by with a description. Could you tell us what the Indian Community School in Milwaukee is?
Absolutely. The Indian Community School is a pre-K through 8th grade school servicing students of American Indian descent in the Milwaukee County area. We're located in Franklin, which is right outside of Milwaukee, and our students come to our grounds, which is 178 acres of land, to gain a good cultural and academic education.
And how do students find out about the school?
One of the ways primarily is word of mouth. We have a lot of family members that have had students that graduated from the Indian Community School, started in 1969 from some parents that were frustrated and wanting to make sure that their students gained a good cultural identity and education. So they started with some homeschooling, and it really has kind of gone on through some traditions, family members sharing with other family members. We're definitely trying to make sure that the community knows more about us, traveling to local reservations and other areas, sharing with schools in the Milwaukee County vicinity, trying to get people aware of what we're doing.
How many tribes are there represented in the school?
So this was a pretty interesting question. It's over 16 tribes, but when we look at the tribes themselves, there's many differences. So even within those 16 different tribes that are currently represented, we have well over 20, because that doesn't take into account different, for instance, Ojibwe tribes that have different bands and they have very distinct governments and locations and reservations. So we're well over 20, but we identify with 16 different specific tribes that will include some Potawatomis together, even though they might come from different reservations, or Ojibwe, or other tribes as well.
You mentioned that some parents initially were frustrated and wanted to make sure their children had a good cultural education. What does that mean, and how does the school address that?
Sure, absolutely. I think that, you know, in the foundings and some of the teachings that I received from those that came before was really that students had a very distinct culture, and in many educational settings, things such as language or traditions or customs that families pass on to their kids aren't able to be taught or valued or shared in a school-type setting. So the students are able to learn a lot about their culture and traditions, including language, and also be a part of many of the teachings that have been passed on from generation to generation.
Now, you said this is an intertribal school, about 20 different tribes represented there, and so that must mean students come with different knowledge, different experiences, different cultures. How does that inform the curriculum?
So that's definitely a continuing task for us to try to make sure that we are addressing to the best of our ability. Within that, it allows the students, so we do our best to try to make sure that we are giving a very wide, diverse experience for our students so that it's not just the knowledge of one tribe or one language or one way of being, but really as many as we can possibly expose our students and staff to. So that's through bringing in people from around the community, different reservations in the state of Wisconsin, experts that live in the area of Milwaukee, the city or county. And we try to continue to grow, and as we grow, then our students can grow. And so as many experiences as we can give them is what we look to do. And through that, they really gain an understanding of acceptance and realizing that there are many ways that people practice what they believe, many different ways of being, and that we are to respect all of those.
We're talking right now with Jason Dropic, head of the Indian Community School near Milwaukee. And Jason, I want to talk about the languages aspect, because that's a part of what the school emphasizes. How many languages are taught there right now?
So currently we have three languages that are taught. We have Oneida, Menominee, and Ojibwe. So all students from K-4 through 8th grade receive language instruction every day. And so they're immersed in language, and we're trying to continue to not just have that in a classroom, but then also throughout our building and with all of our teachers. So teachers are also, if I'm a 4th grade teacher, for instance, I go to a 4th grade language class with my students, and I'm learning right alongside the students. So those three languages, as well as others that come in and visit, but for sure our school, you know, has those three language teachers of those.
How important is that language component to the school and its mission?
It's essential, and so we have a lot of conversations around that. Language, you know, is culture, and a lot of the cultural beliefs and different ways of being and traditions and ceremonies that are held within Native communities, they can't be held without the language. And so keeping that language going, especially as important as language is to a person's state of being and a way of helping them navigate the world around them, is really important to us, because also within that language, there's very meaningful ideas that are taught and concepts that students are able to get, not just from learning words, but really learning about the language and what it means to the people that came before them.
Have you seen that in action with your students, that learning these languages, studying them, opens the door to a greater cultural understanding?
It does. We had last year, for instance, one of our 8th grade students who was able to recite a very, very important Thanksgiving address from the Haudenosaunee in Oneida, and she could do that whole Thanksgiving address really showing thanks for everything that is around us, that has come before us, that's going to come after us, and that giving thanks, putting things into perspective and allowing the students to be able to see outside of themselves is a really important lesson, and to be able to do that in the language I know meant a lot to her, definitely meant a lot to our teachers and our students and our community.
How much of the curriculum would you say centers around the cultural aspects like we've been talking about, and how much would you say is maybe more similar to other schools in Wisconsin?
So that's a good question as well. Our goal with curriculum is always to infuse culture in all that we do. The school is founded on providing students with that culturally grounded teachings and help them navigate the ever-changing world around them. You know, we continue to do our best to provide meaningful academic experience as well, because we know that our students are going to go and live in many different experiences and opportunities and worlds. And so having a good, strong cultural understanding and identity is also important, but a strong academic ability so that there's know, the roadblocks are not in their way and that they can take on whatever challenges they are. You know, our best, we try to do our best to infuse it, and we really want everything that we do, regardless of what it is, to also have a cultural lens that is applied to it. So that's something that we continue to grow. But it's a, you would come into our school, it would look like many other schools. It would feel a little bit different in terms of how the core values kind of ground us in what we do. But it definitely is a school where students are prepared so that they can be successful in the future.
What else is included in the cultural curriculum? We looked at languages. Can you tell us a little bit about the other aspects?
Absolutely. We actually went on a tour where we got to go visit many of the we went to all the reservations in the state of Wisconsin to talk about what do our communities, our stakeholders, what do they expect out of a school that services Native American students. And we came up with strands. We looked at all of the information that was given to us, the over 800 voices that we listened to, and really came into to many different main topics: living in a good way, tribal connections, stories, treaties, sovereignty, tribal government, Indian law and policy, and then connections to the earth. So all of those were really key strands that are also supported here at the school.
And Jason, as we start to wrap up, what is your goal for students at the school, and what do you want them to leave with?
We want them to leave with everything. So can you wish for everything? I suppose you could do that. You know, if we think back to the mission statement of the school, which is that, you know, the Indian Community School cultivates an enduring cultural identity and critical thinking by weaving indigenous teachings with a distinguished learning environment, which is, you know, pretty intense. But what does it really mean? It's that we want our students to have a proud, strong Native identity that prepares them for whatever their future has in store for them. And if with that strong cultural understanding and that really strong base, that they can then take on any obstacles that may come up for in front of them in the future.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Mi gwich. Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
That was Jason Dropick, head of the Indian Community School in Milwaukee.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our look at education now as a part of our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today.
Now, Brooke Emin is with us to talk about the Wadukadatting Ojibwe Language Institute in Hayward, Wisconsin. She's the executive director, and she's Ojibwe. Brooke, welcome to Central Time. The Wadukadatting School is a language school, Brooke, and a language immersion school. But what else do you do there at the Institute?
In 2015, the Wadukadatting Board and staff spent time identifying work that we have been doing and we're doing that supported the school and language development. And we identified that in our effort to teach and speak Ojibwe, we are also doing immersion curriculum, immersion teacher development, contributing to the research and development of best practices for language revitalization, and also doing outreach for language revitalization in our Ojibwe-speaking communities, but also for other indigenous groups. So that was when we redefined our work and created the broader institute model, and that it does continue to include our school in our classrooms.
As I understand it, you're part of an international effort, so you're not just working on the Ojibwe language there. You're working with people all over the world to help restore and revitalize indigenous languages. Can you talk about this huge effort that you're part of?
Yeah, so what we've learned in our work is we've had to reach out and look at models, some of the first models that our founders looked at. We're in New Zealand, in the Welsh language, Gaelic. Like, there's many models in the world of kind of less commonly taught or spoken languages. And we looked at different efforts that were happening. And that also brought us to our relationship with the Native Hawaiian group within the United States as well. So we really looked all over the place for the best ways to revitalize and teach, indigenous languages.
And you're part of the National Coalition of Native American Language Schools and Programs. What role do you play in that coalition?
The coalition is a group of schools and programs. I think we're in 16 states in the United States, and we use an indigenous language as the language of instruction for education. The group is a group that shares knowledge, resources. At times, we also will review any upcoming federal policies to see if they align with the Native American Languages Act of 1990. And that was, it's a law that protects the right to use our native languages in educational settings. So we are part, Wadukurati is part of this coalition, and we really are a group that we share with each other when we need support, not just in any of the policy fields, but also in planning and sharing best practices that we have all developed over time with our programs.
I want to look a little bit at the history here. Ojibwe and other Native and Indigenous languages, they didn't just decline naturally. It seems like there was, as I understand it, a very conscious policy effort in the United States and elsewhere for that matter to force people to stop speaking Indigenous languages. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it really is important to remember that speaking Ojibwe or practicing our culture was outlawed in the not-so-distant past. I was born in the 70s, and, you know, there's no freedom. The freedom of religion for Native Americans was at the end of the 70s, so even when I was born, some of those things were legally prohibited. And I think a lot of what we deal with today is people suffering from shame from some of the trauma inflicted within families and our communities by those efforts. And we know it's one of the reasons American Indian students still struggle with this kind of mainstream English-only focus in our education. So our efforts, you know, normalizing Ojibwe language in education, it's part of our effort, really, to empower, engage students, families, those who have been disenfranchised by the mainstream American education system.
And as I understand it, I mean, it wasn't that long ago where somebody growing up would be actively punished for speaking Ojibwe, say, in an English language school.
Yes, that's my mother had that experience, so her generation, you know, and that was one reason she didn't speak to me until I actively sought her out as an adult and asked her to help me.
We're talking about the Wadukadatting Ojibwe Language Institute in Hayward, Wisconsin. With us, Brooke Amon, Executive Director of the Institute. So what goes into now teaching children Ojibwe in a way that that they can use it in their daily lives?
Well, a lot of it is really using it, role modeling. So we have a lot of adults. We have, you know, our staff at Wadukurating, we're all American Indian Ojibwes. We're role modeling for our children. So they see us speaking to each other, and it elevates its status. But at the same time, we have innovative adults that are working on making sure it stays alive, which means coming up with new words, coming up, you know, adapting to life, our current lives. So we have to have words for things that maybe they didn't have words for in the past. And not only that, but working with elders who are willing to help us revitalize, to talk about how we would even frame some of those concepts. And even in that process, we learn a lot about worldviews and our language and how the language works as well.
I think about someone like your grandmother who was punished for speaking Ojibwe as a kid. What is it like for the elders to see children speaking the language again?
Well, I would say it's probably a mixture of being really happy and excited, but I think there's still some fear there. Even, you know, my mother, who wasn't allowed to speak at school when I first, because I'm also a parent of students in the school program, she was concerned about whether or not they would have the English skills. You know, I went to college and graduate school and everything, and she wants that for them. So she was initially a little concerned that, you know, are they going to be able to speak English also? So I think there's a mixture, but when they speak to her, she's very happy and excited, and she speaks right back to them naturally. She doesn't speak English when they talk to her in Ojibwe. So I think it's a healing process, and we have to deal with, you know, both the good and the bad that comes with healing.
And I understand that you're teaching children the language along with a culture at the same time. And there was an important part of it. Was it, I'm sorry, the maple sugar has a big role to play in it?
Yes, I think one of the parts of working with language revitalization is it goes hand in hand with cultural revitalization. And one of our big focus that we have is reconnecting with our land and also with our food gathering. And so one of our thing, you know, an activity we teach the children and we participate in as a community is gathering food. Like this week, the 6th and 7th graders will finish the wild rice they gathered. In the past couple weeks, the whole school was involved in processing rice that the middle schoolers gathered from one of the lakes. And we really want our students to understand our food systems as well. There's so much science and math embedded within those processes that it's important to include that as part of our education.
And Brooke, as we wrap up, what are your hopes for the future of Wadukadadding?
I think our biggest hopes are that we have more students, more people, more families adopting increased Ojibwe usage, people learning that we can be successfully bilingual by whatever measure we choose to gauge that success. But I think there's also kind of an untapped market for careers and products that are inclusive of the Ojibwe language that can meet the needs of our language revitalization and normalization work. So I am excited to see if we do have some of those efforts, like more media, you know, TV and radio programming, print productions in our language. That's what I think we hope to see as our students grow up, that they include the language in their lives.
Brooke, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Brooke Emin, Executive Director of the Wadukadadding Ojibwe Language Institute.